ourselves and our posterity to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America.
And welcome to We the People. Today's We the People is a rebroadcast of an earlier conversation between Jerry Brown and Helena Norberg Hodge.
Live from Oakland, California, it's We the People with Jerry Brown.
Welcome to another edition of We the People. This hour we're talking to Helena Norberg Hodge, a person who she just tells me speaks eight languages, someone I met many, many years ago when I was governor of California, and our own resources department was reaching out to environmentalists around the world. At that time, she was working in Ladakh. She has a chapter in that wonderful book that we made a premium in the last marathon. That's that book, The Case Against the Global Economy and For a Turn Toward the Local. It's edited by Jerry Mander. And by the way, Jerry Mander and Helena Norberg Hodge will be with us on Monday, but we'll talk more about that and all about the pressure to modernize and globalize. Speaking eight languages, Helena Norberg Hodge has had a chance to see people in many different perspectives and contexts. One thing that globalization is about, it's about making stuff more similar, more the same. Homogenization, Disneyfication, McDonaldization. You can come up with your own four- or five-letter word to describe this incredible phenomenon that is reducing social, cultural, linguistic, and biological diversity. Helena, welcome to We the People.
Thank you.
So tell me,
I'd like to also plug the fact that we're just working on a book on monoculture, and we're dealing with the human monoculture, not just in agriculture. And we've taken pictures around the world to show what it means when you homogenize and Coca-Cola-nize the entire world.
Well, about the time that I met you the first time, it was about the late 70s, I believe, and a fellow who was our state architect, Sim van der Rijn, coined the phrase, or at least he picked it up from somebody and first told it to me, at least that's where I first heard it, bureaucratic monoculture. And this is what he used to describe the state capital plan that my father had commissioned. I don't know whether my father had thought about it. I'm sure he didn't in those terms. But what had turned out in the late 50s, early 60s, what was on the table was best exemplified by Rockefeller's big monumental state capital in Albany, New York, where the state capital was. So California was looking toward very tall buildings, parking lots, fountains, but nobody living. Nothing alive, maybe some well-manicured plants and bushes and flowers and what have you, but not the vibrancy of a town square, of a place where people are, morning, noon, and night. So that's where I heard this term monoculture, bureaucratic monoculture. They talk about it in varieties of corn. Mexico had thousands of different varieties of yellow corn, blue corn, red corn, black corn, incredible. And now, of course, yuppies ate their blue corn chips. But right there on the hillsides outside of Cuernavaca, where I was 15 years ago, there aren't blue corn fields like there had been for 500 years. So that's, I just want to give that by way of context here. But now tell me, last time I saw you, it was Ladakh, wasn't it? You were showing slides on a place that was very different and sustainable.
Yeah, that was, Ladakh is actually part of Tibet culturally. It's West Tibet, and it's a part of Tibet that hasn't been invaded by the Chinese because it belongs politically to India. And I had the amazing experience of ending up there 21 years ago when it had just opened up to the outside world, and I learned to speak the language fluently and got to know the culture from the inside. And also, I think the most important thing in retrospect was that I got to experience the psychological impact of the Western global economy coming in to a place that hadn't been affected by it. And I think, again, in retrospect, what I realize now, too, is that many people, when they travel today or in the last few decades to India, to Africa, to many parts of the world, think that what they're looking at is tradition, think that they're looking at Indian culture, at African culture. But actually they forget that most of the villages they observe were very dramatically changed by colonialism, and that that colonialism wrought enormous changes, you know, redrew boundaries, changed identities, and above all, essentially created slave economies. And this was, Ladakh was very special in that regard because they weren't affected by colonialism. And I think, again, what was so striking was that I came to see that at a deep psychological level, they hadn't been enslaved. They were deeply respectful of themselves as they were. They were deeply at ease with who they were.
Now, there are two points that I remember. One is that it was sustainable in the sense that Ladakh had not experienced population growth, and as if I remember this correctly, I'm just probing you for finding out how you what you were actually experienced. And the other is that there was a polyandry, that women had more than one husband.
That's
or
right.
Could.
That's
could
right.
you elaborate on either or both of
well,
those?
Well,
maybe
is
they're connected.
Yeah, they're certainly connected. But I think the it's interesting that polyandry, where a woman has several husbands, is only common or tends to be common in areas with scarce resources. And Ladakh and Tibet, central Tibet, of course, is this high altitude desert, basically, with scarce resources. And villages there are almost like islands with very clear limits. You can only feed so many people. And yes, they practiced polyandry, that it was usually fraternal polyandry, so that several brothers would have one wife. This went hand in hand with a very strong respect for the religious tradition, for Buddhism. So you also had monasteries where a lot of the celibate men lived, and there were also quite a few nuns. So that this combination of a large section of the population remaining celibate and then polyandry helped to maintain a stable population.
So what's happened since you were last there?
Well, what's happened is that there, as everywhere else in the world, the new model is the nuclear family, is everyone to himself and herself splitting off, and because there aren't very strict measures in terms of contraception and so on, the population is exploding. And it's exploding very rapidly as a consequence of these developments. I've also witnessed that the breakdown of people's connection to the land. In other words, people are being pulled away from the rural village economy into the city in search of paid employment. And there, very soon, they get the impression that the only thing that matters is money. As long as you have more money, there are no limits. And so you find the older
money
generation...
money is what?
And how do you mean money is what?
Well, what is money?
Well, money, in effect, is paper that is being brought in by the Indian government, very much connected to the World Bank, connected to the global economy. And in fact, it becomes a means of pulling people away from their own local rural resources.
So with this kind of money paper, you get to buy stuff in Ladakh that's made in Ladakh, or is it made somewhere else?
Oh, it's made outside.
So that's this isn't paper to the resources of Ladakh?
Absolutely not, no.
So it's a way of disembedding people from the place where they are.
Absolutely. And that disembedding leads very quickly to the sense that there are no limits. And you can hear the older generation saying, oh my God, what's going to happen? You know, the numbers are increasing, population is exploding, where is the food going to come from? But the young, urban, new, monoculturized minds don't see that. I mean, they're thinking just in terms of making more money. They don't see the limits. And there's a very striking difference between the older generation and the newly educated so-called class.
Well, I mean, it's got a pull. You're talking about the young kids in Ladakh. The religion of progress, of capitalism, of the West, of the Occidental mind, communism, all the power of Stalin, and he couldn't stand it, not strong enough. Disney and McDonald's and the bond market are just, I mean, they've made a fool out of Mao Zedong, Karl Marx. And certainly, I guess, the people in Ladakh. So we're looking at a very powerful almost universal religion that seems to have enrolled more believers than Buddhism, Christianity, and Islam, Judaism, and Hinduism all put together.
Well, it's.
I don't want to overstate the power of the market, but it definitely has a lot of. It has a lot of juice.
There's no doubt that it has a lot of juice, but I think it's a very common misconception in the heart of the West that its main power is its seductive quality. And particularly, as you phrased it, in terms of the sort of power of the myth of progress, I don't think that's how it works, because when you talk about the myth of progress, you're talking about a rather intellectual idea. I think what I've experienced very deeply, and in many different places, not just in Ladakh, but in Ladakh it was most dramatic, is that the seduction is primarily a seduction of children. And I am absolutely convinced from my experience, also in rural Spain and Greece, in many less untouched areas than Ladakh, that if there were no children, this particular economy would not succeed. But with children...
There might not be any cigarette smokers either.
Well, that's true. I don't know. Perhaps, I don't know, cigarettes have been around for a long time, and perhaps there would be. But there certainly wouldn't be as many.
There wouldn't be two-pack a day, folks.
Probably not. But I think that what I really see is that the gadgetry of the technology of Western society is very intimidating and to some extent attractive to young men, to little boys. And when they see these tools, and it may have happened with the Native Americans and the Spanish, I don't know, but certainly in my life I've seen it in many places, is that this attraction to certain technologies which seem very powerful and are quite exciting, you know, they allow you to sort of ride through the countryside very fast on a motorbike and so on. They allow you to, you know, to use a tractor instead of a horse and do the job faster. And these things are very attractive to young men, but what they do almost immediately is to create a sense of inferiority, so that the real mechanism is one of making people feel inferior if they're not part of the club, making people feel that they're left behind, that they're, and not only left behind, but I think it's also rightly makes people feel, if I don't join that club, I'm going to be overpowered. And so I think there's a sense of intimidation, a sense of shame, and it operates very much with the young, and particularly with the young men. And that, I would say, is the single most important factor. But then on top of that, you have to keep in mind that this system is a system and that it operates systemically to undermine other cultures. So it has both a way of coming in with huge hooks that get you from behind that on the surface appear very attractive, very neutral. For instance, so-called education, schooling, is presented to you as knowledge about the world, as some neutral, universal knowledge that will edify you, that will make you stronger and wiser. And many people immediately have no reason to question that. It's only afterwards that it becomes apparent that it's killed off the local knowledge, your own language, your own knowledge, and that it's actually trained you into an urban consumer culture. So there are many other
tools. It also stratifies. It teaches you inferiority.
Yeah.
Because unless you're the A student, which it then teaches you your superiority.
Yeah.
But if you're the D student, which
you're
you weren't
nobody.
Before school showed
yeah.
up,
yeah.
and the C student, or the dropout, which most are going to be dropouts, then they have a formal state ideologically pervasively accepted ranking or stratification that is very persuasive.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an added increment of self-imposed inferiority.
And also the way it operates is that in so doing, it divides. You know, it's really a question of conquering, dividing and conquering. Because one of the other tools and mechanisms of the system, not all, I don't think that these have been consciously developed, but I think they're very insidious and quite evil manifestations of quite an evil system. Because it also operates by dividing people from each other. And so young children, and particularly today, are made to feel that if they don't have those running shoes, they're a nobody. They buy the running shoes really out of the motivation is really to receive the sort of recognition love, in a sense, that everybody wants. But instead of giving them that, it divides them further from the group, from the community.
So it's more than rubber on the feet. It has a symbolic message for the mind.
And the symbolic message for the mind, to the young mind, appears to be one of, you know, this will gain me that sense of being someone that old structures of community gave everybody. Now, that's another whole story, because most Westerners don't believe that.
Well, that we can talk about that. Just yes. Probing that school without sounding hostile to school. I certainly went to school for 23 years or so. But there is no doubt that the schooling, when you apply it to a place like in the Himalayas, this is not something that evolved slowly out of Himalayan experience. This has something to do with European medieval monasteries, English colonial education, Manchester, London, steam engine. There's all sorts
Victorian
of things going
England,
on.
Victorian England, really. Victorian England.
Victorian England.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Because we think of school as almost an absolute. You're going to go to school in the first grade, you learn the first level, and the second, and the third, and you go up the line in some kind of course of progressive revelation of what is, when in reality it's a carefully constructed artifact that has a historicity, a particular origin and location that is very specific to the peoples of the world.
That's right.
And it's not the peoples of the world, it's some Englishmen.
It's a very specific culture, and it's the colonial European empire, really, that has thus spread around the world and continues to grow and to spread. And everywhere you find that the educated, so-called, speak one of a few European languages, and that the illiterate, so-called, speak a local vernacular.
So, yeah, you don't learn, you find this even in New York or California. When you go to school, you may learn a little about it. In New York, you'll learn about the Dutch, or maybe some of the Indians gave away the Manhattan Island, a few things like that. But the learning of your location, if you're in the East Village, what was it like 500 years ago? What's the learning of your particular place, soil, trees, animals, history? You're going to get, I believe, in junior year in high school, you get U.S. history. You get world history in fifth grade, fourth grade. There's different schemes that you have in the various states. But the amount given to the lore of where you are is quite minimal, probably non-existent in many cases.
I think also that one of the most important things to keep in mind there is that your economic relationship to place changes so dramatically. And this is what we can still see in the so-called third world today, where roughly 50% of the population is still rooted in a more or less local rural economy, whether it's a small-scale fishermen, farmers, nomads. In fact, just the other day, I heard that the number has just shifted. So that I just learned the other day that the number of people now living in urban areas has shifted, so that it's more than 50% in urban areas now, which is very frightening and very shocking, because this whole process of so-called education is actually a process of pulling people out of rural areas. And what's happening is that you learn nothing about economic survival from your local resources in these schools. You essentially learn how to survive in New York, Rio, Mexico City, which is, of course, a monocultural, cement-based environment. And what it does is it literally lifts the young out of the knowledge and the skills that would allow them to survive from biological diversity.
We're going to stop. That's a good point. Folks, just reflect on that for a bit. That is Helena Norbert Hodge speaking. We're going to come right back. We have to take a break. You're listening to We the People.